You could do something about that hot water heater, Bobby. A voice in her mind spoke up, one that she couldn't identify. A stranger's voice in her head? Oh, golly, should she call the cops? But you could, the voice insisted. All you'd need to do would be... But then the water started to come in warm, tepid, anyway, and she forgot about the water heater. She stirred the gravy train, then set it down and watched Peter eat. He was showing a much better appetite these days. Ought to check his teeth, she thought. Maybe you can go back to Gainesville. A penny saved is a penny earned, and the American reading public is not exactly beating a path to your door, babe, and... And exactly when had the uproar in the clinic started? Anderson thought about this carefully. She couldn't be completely sure, but the more she thought about it, the more it seemed that it might have been, not for sure, but might have been, right after Dr. Etheridge finished examining Peter's cataract and put down the ophthalmoscope. Attend, Watson, the voice of Sherlock Holmes suddenly spoke up in the quick, almost urgent speech rhythms of Basil Rathbone. The eye glows. No, not the eye. The cataract glows. But Anderson does not observe it, although she should. Etheridge does not observe it, and he definitely should. May we say that the animals at the veterinary clinic do not become upset until Peter's cataract begins to glow, until, we might further theorize, the healing process has resumed. Possibly. That the glow is seen only when being seen is safe. Ah, Watson, that is an assumption as frightening as it is unwarranted, because that would indicate some sort of intelligence. Anderson didn't like where this was leading and tried to choke it off with the old reliable advice, let it go. This time it worked. For a while. 2. Anderson wanted to go out and dig some more. Her forebrain didn't like that idea at all. Her forebrain thought that idea sucked. Leave it alone, Bobby. It's dangerous. Right. And by the way, what's it doing to you? Nothing she could see. But you couldn't see what cigarette smoke did to your lungs, either. That's why people went on smoking. It could be that her liver was rotting, that the chambers of her heart were silting up with cholesterol, or that she had rendered herself barren. For all she knew, her bone marrow might be producing outlaw white cells like mad right this minute. Why settle for an early period when you could have something really interesting like leukemia, Bobby? But she wanted to dig it up just the same. This urge, simple and elemental, had nothing to do with her forebrain. It came baking up from someplace deeper inside. It had all the earmarks of some physical craving for salt, for some coke or heroin or cigarettes or coffee. Her forebrain supplied logic. This other part supplied an almost incoherent imperative. Dig on it, Bobby. It's okay. Dig on it. Dig on it. Shit, why not dig on it a while more? You know you want to know what it is, so dig on it till you see what it is. Dig, dig, dig. She was able to turn the voice off by conscious effort, and would then realize 15 minutes later she had been listening to it again, as if to a Delphic oracle. You've got to tell somebody what you found. Who? The police? No way. Or who? She was in her garden, madly weeding, a junkie in withdrawal. Or anyone in authority. Her mind finished. Her right brain supplied Anne's sarcastic laughter as she had known it would, but the laughter didn't have as much force as she had feared. Like a good many of her generation, Anderson didn't put a great deal of stock in let the authorities handle it. Her distrust in the way the authorities handled things had begun at the age of 13 in Utica. She had been sitting on the sofa in their living room with Anne on one side and her mother on the other. She had been eating a hamburger and watching the Dallas police escort Lee Harvey Oswald across an underground parking garage. There were lots of Dallas police, so many, in fact, that the TV announcer was telling the country that someone had shot Oswald before all those police, all those people in authority, seemed to have the slightest inkling something had gone wrong, let alone what it was. So far as she could tell, the Dallas police had done such a good job protecting John F. Kennedy and Lee Harvey Oswald that they had been put in charge of the summer race riots 2 years later, and then the war in Vietnam. Other assignments followed, handling the oil embargo 10 years after the Kennedy assassination, the negotiations to secure the release of the American hostages at the embassy in Tehran, and when it became clear that the ragheads were not going to listen to the voice of reason and authority, Jimmy Carter had sent the Dallas police in to rescue those poor fellers. After all, authorities who had handled that Kent State business with such cool-headed aplomb could surely be counted upon to perform the sort of job those Mission Impossible guys did every week. Well, the old Dallas police had had a spot of tough luck on that one, but by and large they had the situation under control. All you had to do was look at how damned orderly the world situation had become in the years since a man in a strappy T-shirt with Vitalis on his thinning hair and fried chicken grease under his fingernails had blown out a president's brains as he sat in the back seat of a Lincoln rolling down the street of a Texas cow town. I'll tell Jim Gardner when he gets back. Gardner'll know what to do, how to handle it. He'll have some ideas, anyway. Anne's voice.
You're going to ask a certified loony for advice. Great.
He's not a loony, just a little bit weird.
Yeah, arrested at the last Seabrook demonstration with a loaded .45 in his backpack. That's weird, all right.
Anne, shut up.
She weeded. All that morning in the hot sun she weeded, the back of her T-shirt wet with sweat. Last year's scarecrow wearing the hat she usually put on to keep the sun off. After lunch, she lay down to take a nap and couldn't sleep. Everything kept going through her mind, and that stranger's voice never shut up.
Dig on it, Bobby. It's okay. Dig on it.
Until at last she did get up, grabbed the crowbar, spade, and shovel, and set out for the woods. At the far end of her field, she paused, forehead grooved in thought, and came back for her pickaxe. Peter was on the porch. He looked up briefly, but made no move to come with Anderson. Anderson was not really surprised. 3. So about 20 minutes later, she stood above it, looking down the forested slope to the trench she had begun in the ground, freeing what she now believed was a very tiny section of an extraterrestrial spacecraft. Its gray hull was as solid as a wrench or a screwdriver, denying dreams and vapors and supposings. It was there. The dirt she had thrown to either side, moist and black and forest secret, was now a dark brown, still damp from last night's rain. Going down the slope, her foot crunched on something that sounded like newspaper. It wasn't newspaper, it was a dead sparrow. 20 feet further down was a dead crow, feet pointed comically skyward like a dead bird in a cartoon. Anderson paused, looked around, and saw the bodies of 3 other birds, another crow, a blue jay, and a scarlet tanager. No marks. Just dead. And no flies around any of them. She reached the trench and dropped her tools on the bank. The trench was muddy. She stepped in, nevertheless, her work shoes squashing in the mud. She bent down and could see smooth gray metal going into the earth, a puddle standing on one side.
What are you?
She put her hand on it. That vibration sank into her skin and seemed for a moment to go all through her. Then it stopped. Anderson turned and put her hand on her shovel, feeling its smooth wood, slightly warmed by the sun. She was vaguely aware that she could hear no forest noises. None at all. No birds singing, no animals crashing through the undergrowth and away from the smell of a human being. She was more sharply aware of the smells. Peaty earth, pine needles, bark, and sap. A voice inside her, very deep inside, not coming from the right of her brain, but perhaps from the very root of her mind, screamed in terror.
Something's happening, Bobby. Something is happening right now. Get out of here, dead Chuck, dead birds, Bobby. Please, please, please.
Her hand tightened on the shovel's handle, and she saw it again as she had sketched it. The gray leading edge of something titanic in the earth. Her period had started again, but that was all right. She had put a pad in the crotch of her panties even before she went out to weed the garden. A maxi. And there were 6 more in her pack, weren't there? Or was it more like 12? She didn't know, and it didn't matter. Not even discovering some part of her had known she would end up here in spite of whatever foolish conceptions of free will the rest of her mind might possess, disturbed her. A shining sort of peace had filled her. Dead animals. Periods that stopped and started again. Arriving prepared, even after you had assured yourself the decision had not yet been taken. These were small things. Smaller than small, a whole lot of bullshit. She would just dig for a while. Dig on this sucker, see if there was anything but smooth metal skin to see. Because everything's fine, Bobby Anderson said in the unnatural stillness. And then she began to dig. Chapter 5. Gardner Takes a Fall. 1. While Bobby Anderson was tracing a titanic shape with a compass and thinking the unthinkable with a brain more numbed with exhaustion than she knew, Jim Gardner was doing the only work he could these days. This time he was doing it in Boston. The poetry reading on June 25th was at BU. That went all right. The 26th was an off day. It was also the day that Gardner stumbled. Only stumble didn't really describe what happened, unfortunately. It was no minor matter like snagging your foot under a root while you were walking in the woods. It was a fall that he took. One long fucking fall. Like taking a no-expenses-paid bone smasher of a tumble down a long flight of stairs. Stairs? Shit, he had almost fallen off the face of the earth. The fall started in his hotel room. It ended on the breakwater at Arcadia Beach, New Hampshire, 8 days later. Bobby wanted to dig. Guard woke up on the morning of the 26th, wanting to drink. He knew there was no such thing as a partially arrested alcoholic. You were either drinking or you weren't. He wasn't drinking now, and that was good. But there had always been long periods when he didn't even think about booze. Months, sometimes. He would drop into a meeting once in a while. If 2 weeks went by in which Guard didn't attend an AA meeting, he felt uneasy. The way he felt if he spilled the salt and didn't toss some over his shoulder. And stand up and say, "Hi, my name's Jim, and I'm an alcoholic." But when the urge was absent, it didn't feel like the truth. During these periods, he wasn't actually dry. He could and did drink. Drink, that was, as opposed to boozing. A couple of cocktails around 5 if he was at a faculty function or a faculty dinner party. Just that and no more. Or he could call Bobby Anderson and ask if she'd like to come over to go out for a couple of cold ones, and it was fine, no sweat. Then there would come a morning like this, when he would wake up wanting all the booze in the world. This seemed to be an actual thirst, a physical thing. It made him think of those cartoons Virgil Parch used to do in the Saturday Evening Post, the ones where some funky old prospector is always crawling across the desert, his tongue hanging out, looking for a water hole. All he could do when the urge came on him was fight it off, stand it off, try to earn a draw. Sometimes it was actually better to be in a place like Boston when this happened, because you could go to a meeting every night, every 4 hours, if that was what it took. After 3 or 4 days, it would go away. Usually. He would, he thought, just wait it out. Sit in his room and watch movies on cable TV and charge them to room service. He had spent the 8 years since his divorce and severance from college teaching as a full-time poet, which meant he had come to live in an odd little sub-society where barter was usually more important than money. He had traded poems for food, on one occasion a birthday sonnet for a farmer's wife in exchange for 3 shopping bags of new potatoes. "Goddamn thing better rhyme, too," the farmer had said, fixing a stony eye upon Gardner. "Real poems rhyme." Gardner, who could take a hint, especially when his stomach was concerned, composed a sonnet so filled with exuberant masculine rhymes that he burst into gales of laughter after scanning the second draft. He called Bobby, read it to her, and they both howled. It was even better out loud. Out loud it sounded like a love letter from Dr. Seuss. But he hadn't needed Bobby to point out to him that it was still an honest piece of work. Jangly, but not condescending. On another occasion, a small press in West Minot agreed to publish a book of his poems. This had been in early 1983 and was, in fact, the last book of poems Gardner had published, and offered 1/2 cord of wood as an advance. Gardner took it. "You should have held out for 3/4 of a cord," Bobby told him that night as they sat in front of her stove, feet up on the fender, smoking cigarettes as a wind shrieked fresh snow across the fields and into the trees. Those are good poems. There's a lot of them, too.
I know, Gardner said, but I was cold. Half a quart'll get me through until spring.
He dropped her a wink.
Besides, the guy's from Connecticut. I don't think he knew most of it was ash.
She dropped her feet to the floor and stared at him. You kidding?
Nope.
She began to giggle, and he kissed her soundly, and later took her to bed, and they slept together like spoons. He remembered waking up once, listening to the wind, thinking of all the dark and rushing cold outside, and all the warmth of this bed, filled with their peaceful heat under two quilts, and wishing it could be like this forever, only nothing ever was. He had been raised to believe God was love, but you had to wonder how loving a God could be when he made men and women smart enough to land on the moon, but stupid enough to have to learn there was no such thing as forever, over and over again. The next day Bobby had again offered money, and Gardner again refused. He wasn't exactly rolling in dough, but he made out. And he couldn't help the little spark of anger he felt, in spite of her matter-of-fact tone.
"Don't you know who's supposed to get the money after a night in bed?"
he asked. She stuck out her chin. "You calling me a whore?" He smiled.
"You need a pimp? There's money in it, I hear."
"You want breakfast, Gardner, or do you want to piss me off?"
"How about both?"
"No," she said, and he saw she was really mad. Christ, he was getting worse and worse at seeing things like that, and it used to be so easy. He hugged her.
"I was only kidding. Couldn't she see that?" he thought. "She always used to be able to tell when I was kidding."
But of course she hadn't known he was kidding, because he hadn't been. If he believed different, the only one getting kidded was himself. He had been trying to hurt her because she'd embarrassed him, and it wasn't her offer that had been stupid. It was his embarrassment. He had more or less chosen the life he was living, hadn't he? And he didn't want to hurt Bobby, didn't want to drive Bobby away. The bed part was fine, but the bed part wasn't the really important part. The really important part was that Bobby Anderson was a friend, and something scary seemed to be happening just lately. How fast he seemed to be running out of friends. That was pretty scary, all right.
Running out of friends? Or running them out? Which is it, Gard?
At first, hugging her was like hugging an ironing board, and he was afraid she would try to pull away, and he would make the mistake of trying to hold on. But she finally softened.
"I want breakfast," he said. "And to say I'm sorry."
"It's all right," she said, and turned away before he could see her face. But her voice held that dry briskness that meant she was either crying or near it. "I keep forgetting it's bad manners to offer money to Yankees." Well, he didn't know if it was bad manners or not, but he would not take money from Bobby. Never had, never would. The New England Poetry Caravan, however, was a different matter.
"Grab that chicken, son,"
Ron Cummings, who needed money about as much as the Pope needed a new hat, would have said.
"The bitch is too slow to run and too fat to pass up."
The New England Poetry Caravan paid cash, coin of the realm for poetry, 200 up front and 200 at the end of the tour. The word made flesh, you might say. But hard cash, it was understood, was only part of the deal. The rest was the tab. While you were on tour, you took advantage of every opportunity. You got your meals from room service, your hair cut in the hotel barbershop, if there was one, brought your extra pair of shoes, if you had one, and put them out one night instead of your regulars so you could get the extras shined up. There were the in-room movies, movies you never got a chance to see in a theater, because theaters persisted in wanting money for much the same thing poets, even the very good ones, were, for some reason, supposed to provide for free, or next to it. 3 bags of spuds equals one sonnet, for instance. There was a room charge for the movies, of course, but what of that? You didn't even have to put them on the tab. Some computer did it automatically. And all Gardner had to say on the subject was God bless and keep the tab and bring those fuckers on. He watched everything, from Emmanuel in New York finding the part where the girl flogs the guy's doggy and her table at Windows on the World particularly artistic and uplifting. It certainly uplifted part of him, anyway. To Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, to Rainbow Bright and the Star Stealer. And that's what I'm going to do now, he thought, rubbing his throat and thinking about the taste of good aged whiskey. Exactly what I'm going to do. Just sit here and watch them all over again, even Rainbow Bright. And for lunch, I'm going to order 3 bacon cheeseburgers and eat one cold at 3 o'clock. Maybe skip Rainbow Bright and take a nap. Stay in tonight. Go to bed early. And stand it off. Bobby Anderson tripped over a 3-inch tongue of metal protruding from the earth. Jim Gardiner tripped over Ron Cummings. Different objects, same result. For want of a nail. Ron popped in around the same time that, some 210 miles away, Anderson and Peter were finally getting home from their less-than-normal trip to the vets. Cummings suggested they go down to the hotel bar and have a drink or 10. Or, Ron continued brightly, we could just skip the foreplay and get shit-faced. If he had put it more delicately, Gard might have been okay. Instead, he found himself in the bar with Ron Cummings, raising a jolly Jack Daniels to his lips and telling himself the old one about how he could choke it off when he really wanted to. Ron Cummings was a good, serious poet who just happened to have money practically falling out of his asshole, or so he often told people. I am my own de Medici, he would say. I have money practically falling out of my asshole. His family had been in textiles for roughly 900 years and owned most of southern New Hampshire. They thought Ron was crazy, but because he was the second son, and because the first one was not crazy, i.e. uninterested in textiles, they let Ron do what he wanted to do, which was write poems, read poems, and drink almost constantly. He was a narrow young man with a TB face. Gardiner had never seen him eat anything but beer nuts and goldfish crackers. To his dubious credit, he had no idea of Gardner's own problem with booze, or the fact that he had once come very close to killing his wife while drunk. Okay, Gardner said. I'm up for it. Let's get faced. After a few in the hotel bar, Ron suggested that a couple of smart fellers like them could find a place with entertainment a tad more exciting than the piped-in muzak drifting down from the overhead speakers. I think my heart can take it, Ron said. I mean, I'm not sure, but... God hates a coward, Gardner finished. Ron cackled, clapped him on the back, and called for the tab. He signed it with a flourish and then added a generous tip from his money clip. Let's boogie, my man. And off they went. The late afternoon sun lanced Gardner's eyes like glass spears, and it suddenly occurred to him that this might be a bad idea. Listen, Ron, he said. I think maybe I'll just... Cummings clapped him on the shoulder. Formerly pale cheeks flushed, formerly watery blue eyes blazing. To Gard, Cummings now looked rather like Toad of Toad Hall after the acquisition of his motor car, and cajoled, Don't crap out on me now, Jim. Boston lies before us so various and new, glistening like the fresh ejaculate of a young boy's first wet dream. Gardner burst into helpless gales of laughter. That's more like the gardener we've all come to know and love, Ron said, cackling himself. God hates the coward, Gard said. Hail as a cab, Ronnie. He saw it then, the funnel in the sky, big and black and getting closer. Soon it was going to touch down and carry him away. Not to Oz, though. A cab pulled over to the curb. They got in. The driver asked them where they wanted to go. Oz, Gardner muttered. Ron cackled. What he means is someplace where they drink fast and dance faster. Think you can manage that? Oh, I think so, the driver said and pulled out. Gardner draped an arm around Ron's shoulders and cried, Let the wild rumpus start. I'll drink to that, Ron said. 2. Gardner awoke the next morning, fully dressed in a tub full of cold water. His best set of clothes, which he'd had the misfortune to be wearing when he and Ron Cummings set sail the day before, were bonding themselves slowly to his skin. He looked at his fingers and saw they were very white and very pruny, fish fingers. He'd been here for a while, apparently. The water might even have been hot when he climbed in. He didn't remember. He opened the tub drain, saw a bottle of bourbon standing on the toilet seat. It was half full, its surface bleary with some sort of grease. He picked it up. The grease smelled vaguely of fried chicken. Gardner was more interested in the aroma coming from inside the bottle. "Don't do this," he thought. But the neck of the bottle was rapping against his teeth before the thought was even half finished. He had a drink, blacked out again. When he came to, he was standing naked in his bedroom with the phone to his ear and the vague idea that he had just finished dialing a number. Whose? He had no idea until Cummings answered. Cummings sounded even worse than Gardner felt. Gardner would have sworn this was impossible.
How bad was it?
Gardner heard himself ask. It was always this way when he was in the grip of the cyclone. Even when he was conscious, everything seemed to have the gray, grainy texture of a tabloid photograph, and he never seemed to exactly be inside of himself. A lot of the time he seemed to be floating above his own head, like a kid's silvery puffer balloon.
How much trouble did we get into?
Trouble? Cummings repeated and then fell silent. At least Gardner thought he was thinking, hoped he was thinking, or maybe dreaded the idea. He waited, his hands very cold.
No trouble,
Cummings said at last, and Gard relaxed a little.
Except for my head, that is. I got my head in plenty of trouble. Jesus!
You sure?
Nothing. Nothing at all.
He was thinking of Nora.
Shot your wife, huh?
A voice spoke up suddenly in his mind. The voice of the deputy with a comic book.
Good fucking deal. Well,
Cummings said reflectively and then stopped. Gardner's hand clenched tight on the phone again.
Well?
What? Suddenly the lights in the room were too bright. Like the sun when they had stepped out of the hotel late yesterday afternoon.
You did something. You had another fucking blackout and did another stupid thing, or crazy thing, or horrible thing. When are you going to learn to leave it alone, or can you learn?
An exchange from an old movie clanged stupidly into his mind. Evil El Comandante.
Tomorrow, before daybreak, senor, you will be dead. You have seen the sun for the last time.
Brave Americano.
Yeah, but you'll be bald for the rest of your life.
What was it? He asked Ron.
What did I do? You got into an argument with some guys at a place called the Stone Country Bar and Grill,
Cummings said. He laughed a little.
Oh, Christ, when it hurts to laugh, you know you abused yourself. You remember the Stone Country Bar and Grill and them there good old boys, James, my dear?
He said he didn't. Really straining, he could remember a place called Smith Brothers. The sun had just been going down in a kettle of blood, and this being late June, that meant it had been, what, 8:30, quarter of nine? About 5 hours after he and Ron had gotten started, give or take. He could remember the sign outside bore the likeness of the famous cough drop siblings. He could remember arguing furiously about Wallace Stevens with Cummings, shouting to be heard over the juke, which had been thundering out something by John Fogerty. That was where the last jagged edges of memory came to a halt.
It was the place with the Waylon Jennings for president bumper sticker over the bar,
Cummings said.
That refreshed the old noggin?
No,
Gardner said miserably.
Well, you got into an argument with a couple of the good old boys. Words were passed. These words grew first warm and then hot. A punch was thrown.
By me.
Gardner's voice was now only dull.
By you,
Cummings agreed cheerfully.
At which point we flew through the air with the greatest of ease, landing on the sidewalk. I thought we got off pretty cheap, to tell you the truth. You had them frothing, Jim.
Was it about Seabrook or Chernobyl?
Shit, you do remember.
If I remembered, I wouldn't be asking you which one it was. As a matter of fact, it was both.
Cummings hesitated.
Are you all right, Gard? You sound real low.
Yeah, well, actually, Ron, I'm way up. Up in the cyclone. going around and around and up and down, and where it ends, nobody knows.
I'm okay. That's good. One hopes you know who you have to thank for it.
You, maybe.
None other. Man, I landed on that sidewalk like a kid hitting the ground the first time he comes off the end of a slide. I can't quite see my ass in the mirror, but that's probably a good thing. I bet it looks like a Dayglo Grateful Dead poster from 69. But you wanted to go back in and talk about how all the kids around Chernobyl were going to be dead of leukemia in 5 years. You wanted to talk about how some guys almost blew up Arkansas looking for faulty wiring with a candle in a nuclear power plant. You said they caught the place on fire. Me, I'd bet my watch, and it's a Rolex, that they were Snopeses from M-I-E-S-I-P-P-I. Only way I could get you into a cab was by telling you we'd come back later and bust heads. I sweet-talked you up to your room and started the tub for you. You said you were all right. You said you were going to take a bath and then call some guy named Bobby.
The guy's a girl,
Gardner said absently. He was rubbing at his right temple with his free hand.
Good looking?
Pretty. No knockout.
An errant thought. Nonsensical, but perfectly concrete.
Bobby's in trouble.
Kicked across his mind the way an errant billiard ball will roll across the clean green felt of a pool table. Then it was gone.